Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is December 13th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm back in Tennessee with Franklin, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Precious Metals Market Report. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about. Check out the slides on the webinar software. We're going to be doing some slides both for all the different parts of the Soleri Report tonight, but we have a couple of charts for precious metals as well, and I want to make sure you don't miss out on them. Well, of course, as I said last time, the holidays are here. We sent out our annual Christmas card. There's a little ad up on the homepage, the blog, and you can just click on it and see the Christmas card. It's Santa's workshop, but this time Santa is using a 3D printer. And in the card, we have made, thanks to your help and input, 4 donations to some wonderful groups. And I would encourage you, if you haven't picked out sort of who you're designating for your year-end donations, those are 4 we can recommend to you. You can just check them out by going over and seeing the Christmas card. Also, if you haven't accessed it, we've sent to every subscriber a gift offer that allows each subscriber to offer a 1-month subscription to the Soleri Report through the end of January to somebody that you designate, someone of your own choosing. We had more than a few subscribers at the last lunches and various feedback saying they would love for family and friends to get the beginning of the year strategic pieces. You've got the year-end wrap-up in the first week of January, and then the Precious Metals Market Report in January, the first one with Franklin, and then the equity overview. And so those are great things. So go ahead. We sent you all a link, and we'll send out another one, or you can access it from the subscriber resource page. Just head in and gift a subscription to somebody that you want to bless this Christmas. Our theme tonight, and believe it or not, this is a sign that sits in my office. I got it from a Swiss money manager who I admire tremendously. And the sign in my office says, drink upstream from the herd. And as you watch what's going on, there's a lot that the herd is doing. And it's very, very important to me on an ongoing basis, but particularly going into the year-end wrap-up and all these different things. I really want you to see the game because I want to make sure that you, think of what's going on right now as a wave. We have watched the financial coup d'etat unfold, and now as that money has been shifted, we're watching it come back in and help engineer a political re-engineering. That's part of what the fiscal cliff negotiations are about. And I want to make sure that wave is one that you know how to surf and it's not one that runs you over. So you definitely want to see what the herd is up to, but you want to drink upstream from the herd. Money and markets, so many things going on, and many of them I want to talk with Franklin about. We're seeing now announced this morning the U.S. and European Union are ready to start trade negotiations about taking the relationship to a whole new level. Imagine, if you will, moving towards a free trade zone between the U.S. and the European Union. It's a pretty dramatic action. The most dramatic action was the Fed announcing that in addition to QE3, the $45 billion that they're buying through Operation Twist, instead of selling $45 billion long and buying short for a net, twisting the yield curve, but not a net addition, the Fed announces instead that they're just going to buy the $45 billion. And that means if they continue that, that's the equivalent of $1 trillion to be added to the money supply, a pretty significant addition. We saw the markets react very sort of bullish for both stocks and precious metals was the immediate reaction. And then, boom, last night, both markets dropped like a stone. And then today, the top five central banks, both the Federal Reserve, Canada, and the UK, the European Union, and the Swiss, announcing a major swap program to provide liquidity. That's a very strong statement from the central banks that they're going to back up the Fed to add liquidity to the market. It says to me that things are very tense in central bank land. Of course, we have the ongoing fiscal cliff negotiations and a sign now that the president's willing to put corporate taxes on the table, although, you know, that may work out to be something quite different than it sounds. We did the Saleri report last week, very popular on the tax changes that could come out of the fiscal cliff and what that could mean to your taxes. There's some very good things to consider before the end of the year. If you haven't listened to it, I would recommend it. And the transcript is up, too. You can also take a look at the transcript. But what we're really seeing is the debate has all been around individual taxes. And, of course, if you look at the collections chart that we put up last week showing IRS collections since the mid-90s, what you'll see is the corporations really are not paying their fair share. The biggest problem is not who's paying what. The biggest problem is the pie has been shrinking. And the reality is, as you centralize the economy, you shrink the economy. As the economy shrinks, government has the ability to force to take more in taxes, and the government market share of the whole economy has grown. You know, sometimes I laugh and say that the Soviet Union won the Cold War because our economy has become so Soviet-like. But take a look at that chart on IRS collections, because it will tell you a lot. One of the things I want to talk about with Franklin is how to break that down and start to see the federal flows by your area, because, of course, that's where a lot of the opportunity is. I was on Coast to Coast on Tuesday night for 3 hours talking about the fiscal cliff. And, in fact, someone put that up on YouTube, and I put it up for subscribers on the blog if you want to listen. George Norrie and I were doing Q&A for about an hour and a half, and it still has surprised me how literally you see a country that can't broker a political compromise, really for two reasons. One is that the deep structural problems are very serious, and of course we're not talking about them, we're just talking about how we collect up more revenue. That's number one. But number two, if you look at all the different constituencies involved, there's really not enough understanding of what the problems are or how to get them back to something where the pie is getting bigger instead of smalling. In terms of a very interesting article that was up on the blog, Ed Easterling wrote an article called Looming Crisis about the impact that the fiscal cliff negotiations and reengineering of the federal budget could have on state and local municipalities and what that could do to state budgets and to municipal credits. And it's really part of the deeper story. I think it's worth taking a look at. Another great story, piece from the American Conservative on the Harvard endowment, basically saying Harvard was a hedge fund with a small university as an add-on, and a pretty good piece. And I would encourage you to look at it. A lot more debate, again, up on the blog about the role of pension funds and what's coming. One piece, CalPERS is now trying to set a legal precedent that in the bankruptcy, in a Chapter 9 bankruptcy for San Bernardino and Stockton, that their position is senior to other creditors in a bankruptcy. You know, who knows how that turns out, but it could do have a very interesting position or a very interesting result in how pension funds play out in the reengineering of municipal government. Another interesting story in the Hostess bankruptcy, it turns out before the bankruptcy, rather than making the employee and pension fund due, the money was taken aside and used to pay senior management bonuses. Very, very disturbing. Treasury is selling their AIG stock. That's the last piece to go, and it puts an end to a very sensitive chapter in the bailouts, because AIG is an organization that has tremendous, tremendous secrets and handling of highly complex liabilities, including for the federal government. And so I'm sure Treasury is very happy to see that piece go. A number of stories on drones. I keep following drones on the blog. First, we had a story last week that Google was going to be helping with drones in Africa. The pretext was to protect wildlife from predators. And I put up a little note saying, beware the justification of this for good works and where this could go. This could really be used to push indigenous people off their land. Another story, the U.S. military is backing the development of drones with lasers. And I put it up on the blog under the title, The Tax and Debt Collector Cometh. It's not, to me, unconnected that we're seeing an effort to launch drones, including weaponized drones, across America at the same time that there's lots of talk of raising taxes. I think the two are very much connected, just like the effort to try and get gun control. It's much easier to tax people if they're not well armed. And in that vein, we saw another mall shooting or another sort of community shooting this week. Something's up in Syria. The president, on an interview with Barbara Walters, recognized the opposition rebels as the legitimate government representative. It's very interesting to see state actions announced on the Barbara Walters interviews. But there you have it. So, and we continue to see stories about accumulations of real estate, and I continue to post those on the blog. I'm very interested if you're seeing a tight real estate market with foreclosures in your community, because it looks like private investors are putting together very large aggregations of single family resident housing. I would love to know about it. Several other reports that are important this week. Apparently, the U.S. birth rate is at a record low since the Great Depression. Also, some great pieces on GMOs. Rappaport continues to do a great series on GMO, and that's up on the blog. The UK announced that they're moving forward with liberalizing permissions for GMOs, very unfortunately. Finally, probably in one respect, the biggest story of the week, HSBC. Hong Kong, HSBC initially stood for Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, announced a $1.92 billion settlement with the U.S. government for money laundering. Not one corporate officer was indicted, and the corporation, no criminal charges were brought against the corporation either. This is pretty remarkable. We also had this week a U.N. advisor saying that during the bailout, it was drug money that kept the banking system afloat. You kind of wonder what the connection was between those two announcements. Remember, the head of the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, is Eric Holder. Eric Holder was the head of the D.C. He was the D.C. Attorney, U.S. Attorney General during the 90s. And it was literally under his leadership that the Department of Justice and HUD and federal agencies were dropping SWAT teams into low-income communities around the country and in D.C., sweeping up teenagers who just made the mistake of happening to be around, pulled the money on the public defender's offices, and basically jammed tremendous number of people into prisons on the war on drugs. I tell the story in the Dylan Reed article, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I mention this because if you look at how the process unfolded, led by Eric Holder, among others, there was no difference between what we were doing and the Nazis were doing in terms of rounding people up and putting them in slave labor camps, because in fact, what happened was the private prisons, through the Department of Justice, negotiated contracts with the Department of Defense so that prisoners could work making uniforms and other jobs, primarily for the military and federal agencies. So we literally have a situation where Eric Holder et al. Leads the rounding up of innocent people and putting them in prison, while HSBC is allowed to proceed with massive amounts of money laundering and simply a fine, in which you realize, in fact, the Department of Justice was simply looking for a cut of their piece, because you can't begin to launder that amount of money without the intelligence agencies and the Federal Reserve. I mean, if you look at how the clearance systems, there's no way this happens without the system allowing it to happen. The reality is, if you look at the name Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, it was a lead bank in the Anglo-American Alliance that grew out of the Chinese opium trade and drug trade. So there you have it. But the boldness and the clarity of HSBC settling a $1.92 billion settlement for drug and various illegal money laundering with not one criminal indictment up against the number of people who've been stuffed into prison on the war on drugs for, you know, either unfortunately not being able to hire an attorney or smoking a marijuana joint. We couldn't be looking at a more clear relief. And so a lot of tense feeling about the HSBC story. Well, many more things to talk about, but actually, I would love to talk about them with Franklin. So, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here, but I have to warn you that I'm losing my voice. So if it sounds like I've got a cough drop in my mouth, it's because I do.
Oh no! You've got 12 more days to Christmas. How are you going to do this?
I don't know. I hope I can get rid of it by then.
Okay. Well, let me start off because I am in the holiday mood. I put this up on the blog post, and I just wanted to remind everybody of it because one of the things off and on that I've done for Christmas is give children the silver and gold coins. And the hardest thing, it used to drive me crazy trying to keep straight what I was giving to different kids, you know, because I had different things in the inventory. And then keeping the amount straight Christmas to Christmas and birthday to birthday. And so when Franklin told me about his idea for a silver and gold payment calculator, I immediately realized what genius it was, because that was the one thing standing between me and really liquidity of gift giving with silver and gold. So maybe, Franklin, because it is the holiday season and the calculator is such a great little tool to help our subscribers who would like to give gifts to the kids and to anybody, obviously, but I think it's great to introduce children to gold and silver and get them saving because, you know, you want something that's going to hold their value between the age of 5 and college. So maybe if you could just describe a little bit the silver and gold calculator.
Well, the calculator, if you just punch in the amount, the dollar amount that you want to use, or the euro amount for that matter, I think there's 30-something different currencies, and it tells you what the conversion is. So if you say, well, I want to spend about $35, you punch it in there, and if you tell it you want 1 ounce rounds, it'll tell you that you get about 1 ounce round for that. But the thing about giving silver or gold is I've never had anybody look at it and say, gee, I didn't want that. I mean, especially the, you know, silver coins. And, you know, I even give my grandkids half dollars, you know, the older half dollars. And they uh-huh. think it's the neatest thing in the world. So it really, you know. It's a great gift. It works really well.
I love the look on their face. They're always like, wow. And then mom or dad always grabs it and says, oh, I'm putting this in a safe place. And that affirms for them that it was a really cool present. Because if mom and dad are that worked up about it, it must really, really be good. Okay. Well, the silver and gold calculator is at silverandgoldormoney.com. And you can link to it from the Soleri website, and I believe you can link to it from the Money Changer website.
Yes,
right?
and there's an app. There's an iPhone app and an Android app, too.
Android app. So you can put it on your... I use it to track the gold and silver price throughout the year, so I recommend it. Okay, so Franklin, tell us about the market. The market has been very exciting since last we spoke.
Well, it has, and it's been a little bit hard to parse, and I'll just go in and say I clearly made a mistake. We got that run up to $1,800 where we made a double top right at the end of September and the beginning of October, and then we came back, and I was waiting for that as the bottom of a second wave, and I really just missed the fact that it would probably come back up again and then go back down again. So it's been real hard to read. At least it's been hard for me to read in the last month and a half or so. But basically, silver and gold have gone sidewise. Today's market made no sense at all to me, because after news that the Federal Reserve is going to add $1.02 trillion to the money supply this year, the dollar actually rose. Now, it didn't rise much, but it did rise. And the stock market went down, too. And, of course, and gold and silver took a big lick. Markets are so disturbed and roiled by this whole fiscal cliff business. I just think you're going to continue to see that until there's some kind of resolution. I think the whole thing is ridiculous because nothing of substance will come out of it, I don't believe, except nothing that will help us. But until that stops, we're just not going to get any clarity in the market. The dollar's broken down since last month, and the yen is going out of the world backwards. You know, I have a theory that the bottom on the exchange rate for the yen is about 85 yen to the dollar, which is about, if you turn it around the other way, it's 117.5 cents for 100 yen. I think there's a range that they shoot for, that these central banks shoot for, and I think after 118, they're going to get real antsy, and the Fed is going to step in. They're not going to let the Japanese depreciate their currency any more than that. Now, that's just my crazy idea, but if you notice that over a long period of time, currencies tend to trade in bands. And clearly, right. We know that these central banks work together. So, you added something tonight in our conversation that I really hadn't thought about. One of the reasons the nice government men may be manipulating silver and gold down, especially gold, is they don't want it to finish the year strongly because that will make stocks look bad. But also, I went and looked at the yield on the 10-year treasury, and the yield on the 10-year treasury has been rising.
You know, the chairman of Goldman Sachs came out the other day and warned about higher interest rates. And you had several sort of noticeable warnings about the great bond bull market may be over. I think they're the reason that they want to keep gold on a managed rise, and I think they do want it to rise, they just want it managed, is they're trying to keep all that paper floating around in the bond market. And one of the ways you keep an investor in the bond market is by having lots of volatility in the precious metals and in the stock market. So tangibles are volatile, and that pushes people back in the bond market. But I think they're, you know, it's like trying to keep a herd in the bond market and keep it from stampeding out. And you've got yields down to almost nothing. How do you keep them from stampeding out? Well, if the whistle, you know, if the announcement goes out, oh, gold's on a new step up, then you've got a, you know, the precious metals market is tiny and the bond market is huge. All it takes is a little itty-bitty amount of money coming out of the bond market, and it goes flying to precious metals, and then you could get a real stampede. So I think they're trying to keep everybody back in the corral in the bond market.
There's a widespread misapprehension that the Fed controls interest rates. The Fed does not control interest rates any more than a mahout controls an elephant that he's riding on. That is, he controls the elephant as long as the elephant wants to be controlled. The Fed controls interest rates at the margin. They have this one little Fed funds rate that they change, and then they go into the market and they may buy and sell bonds to try and influence the price, which is the reciprocal of the interest rate. But interest rates have been low a long, long time, and they've kept them low a long, long time. And they've announced that they're going to keep them low a long, long time. And the problem is when you artificially suppress any market, whether you hold the market up or you keep the market down, the time that you get the huge movement and huge spring back is when you remove that suppression or you lose control of it. And so
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Fed manipulated the price of gold down because they're trying to keep that interest rate from going up. And after the announcement they made yesterday and the other central banks made about these swaps, well, you've got to be some kind of fool not to notice that they've told you they're going to inflate. So,
well, the if you look at the drop in interest rates, it very much parallels the growth of derivatives. And the biggest portion of derivatives is interest rate swaps. And those positions are very much run by the big member, New York Fed member banks. You know, it's basically a handful of New York Fed member banks. And my guess is, you know, and I keep coming back to the same thing, that those positions are basically exchange stabilization positions done as agent for the U.S. government. And the thing that's chilling about someone like Lloyd Blankfein, chairman of Goldman Sachs, saying interest rates are coming up is you're basically talking about the, you know, if there is one person who was part of engineering the strong dollar policy, whether it was the suppression of the gold price or the bubbling of the mortgage market or the engineering of the derivative swaps, you know, it was Lloyd coming out of the commodities markets and, you know, and fixed income markets, including mortgage markets at Goldman Sachs. So one of the reasons these guys have such a commanding, you know, ability to act lawlessly with impunity is they're the ones who are keeping this whole bubble going. And if they don't keep the bubble going, then everybody's check stops, which means they're in the catbird seat they control. And so if they've been engineering the interest rate swaps and suddenly now they're saying interest rates might go up, what's that about? Because that's, to me, that's a federal, they're managing a federal government position, and that's a pretty blunt, open negotiation through the media about something. So I think it's a, you know, we're looking at a system which is way too centralized, and it depends on a handful of firms, both in the United States and then globally, to engineer these things. And, of course, the more leveraged and centralized it gets, the more force it needs to keep the thing going. And the problem, ultimately, Franklin, is not derivatives or, you know, the bond market or any of this. The problem, of course, is lawlessness is afoot and we're shrinking the pie. And what we need to do is change things in a way that the pie starts to get bigger. And that's very hard to do in a system where the trust is breaking down.
Well, if, even if they wanted to do that, they, you know, when you climb up on the tiger, how do you get off the tiger? And by suppressing interest rates as long as they have, they climbed on a tiger and they're holding on to his ears. And now when they, even if they had the best will in the world and wanted to get out of it, how could they do it? I mean, it would be a very difficult maneuver. So they, you know, they have to keep it going somewhere or the other, which of course means, is to bring us back around, they have to keep the price of gold from running away.
Well, I think, you know, I've had so many people comment to me that when they watch people in Congress or the administration talk about the fiscal cliff, that they don't make any sense. And the reality is you've got a group of politicians who are sitting between two constituencies, one who's above the law and is very powerful, and the other who doesn't want to hear, you know, the bad news. And so the problem is they can't find a political compromise to work their way through those two different constituencies. Because if you, you know, you're trying to solve a problem inside a box, and the only way you can solve the problem is to go outside the box. But, you know, there's a variety of parties who... Go ahead.
Let me just throw one other thing in there. What has become of the United States when the entire government, the whole future of the country, is held hostage to two men negotiating? How did we get to that stage? Because it's not the whole Congress. It's not even the whole Republican part of the Congress that's negotiating. It's Obama negotiating with Boehner.
Right, and if you look at what they're negotiating with, it won't solve the problem. What they're negotiating about is another kick the can. Now, it's interesting. As you know, I've always believed that one of the important steps to a solution was to bring the problem down to a county or congressional district level. Because, in fact, if you're going to re-engineer the federal budget, and I argue still that you could re-engineer the federal budget in a way that could really solve the problem. You know, I don't care how much debt there is, because that's how much wealth there is, you know, and the earth brings forth another round of wealth every year. And we do happen to sit on probably arguably the best piece of real estate on the planet. So I think there's a lot that could be done, but a lot of it is bringing the information down to a county level. And I want to tell the story because I remember one time coming over here, it was many years ago, and pulling up the computer and dialing into all the websites to let you see a sources and uses of government money, federal government money in Tennessee, and then for some programs in your county. And I remember how shocked you were to see those flows and the explosion of information and sort of creativity that came out of you when you started to break the numbers down to a level, you know, that corresponded to the world that you knew.
Well, that
maybe you could describe
that, actually,
what happened.
That event was a big turning point. You just sat down and you said, "Here, look, let me show you this website where I can show you what all the who gets all the agricultural subsidies in your county." And there it is on the Environmental Working Group website. And the amazing thing is that what it shows is that fewer than 20% of the farmers get the vast majority of the subsidies. It's just astounding. And from that, you went to the, I can't think of the name of the website.
It used to be called Eagle Eye. It's not available anymore, but it would show you all federal spending in Tennessee and all grants and contracts.
And it was just totally astounding because there was somebody like the East Chinese Noodle Company that was getting $20 million a year. Or what? I don't know. I mean, it was just astounding. But after you showed me that, is when I sat down and I looked at the GDP of various southern states and added up as much of the spending as I could get. And that's when I began to figure out, look, 50% of our income in most states comes from federal government spending. Now, whether that's
right.
defense spending or Social Security, and the Social Security is the small part of it. The food stamps is the small part of it. That's not where the money's going. We literally have a government-run economy. And I just never had realized how huge it was before.
One of the charts we showed last week is the percentage of the economy run through the federal budget. And I think that's part of what's making the pie shrink, because you're talking about an economy that's less and less entrepreneurial, less and less creative, more and more subject to complex rules, et cetera, et cetera. So
there's a good example of this. Just a few days ago, I saw a chart of the collapse in the alternative energy business, and it fell about 63% in 1 year. Well, the reason the alternative energy business can't go anywhere is because the government keeps subsidizing it. And it's just it's not that they're not good alternative energy sources or ideas, but they're more expensive than tying into the grid. And so you've got to have some kind of entrepreneurial ability and technological shift to make that work. But instead, the government wastes resources by pouring money into these companies that don't have a solution. I mean, it's just...
Right, well, it's...
And now we've got the same problem, but we've got less money to solve it with, is what it amounts to.
Right. Right, much less money to solve it with. But, you know, I hate to be the bad guy. This is one of the reasons everybody hates me to talk about this. If you took 50% of the money that we spent as a society on hard narcotics and 50% of the money that we spent on the lottery and then 50% of the time we spent watching TV and you reinvested that in building our local economies, I dare say that's plenty of money to rebuild the local economy. Okay? So let me be a tough guy. The one thing I wanted to point out to everybody, and I've started to help some of my clients with this, is you can look at the comprehensive annual financial reports for every municipality, county, and state. You have a comprehensive annual financial report, and it will show you a lot about, if you get a group of friends together and start pouring through those financials and start looking at how the money works, I think that you will over time find a lot of very interesting information on what is going around you. So I would encourage you to do that. Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight, Franklin, and I will get back to the market and where you think the market's going. One of the things I wanted to talk about was we got a question about the Liberty Dollar from someone who said, look at what the government has let HSBC off with no indictments, but look at what look at what they're doing to the founder of the Liberty Dollar. And so I wanted to talk a little bit because off and on I've tried to warn people to stay away from the Liberty Dollar. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what I call beware the alternative, because you and I seem to be the recipient of every new idea on how to solve our economic woes. And of course, so we see a lot of alternatives, and I dare say that many of the alternatives, in my opinion, are worse than, worse than what we've got going on now. And, they're certainly not a solution, or they would make matters worse. And I think the Liberty Dollar is one. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about the Liberty Dollar and some of the other alternatives floating around, because I want to make sure that our subscribers do not lose time or money, sort of going down the rat hole of different alternatives. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about the Liberty Dollar.
Well, the fellow who did it was Bernard von Nothaus, who had a mint in Hawaii, and he minted, gold coins that were basically souvenirs, Hawaiian items and so forth. And then he cooked up this idea that he would offer this Liberty Dollar, and he would sell this 1 ounce coin for a dollar or for $10 when silver was about $4.50 or $5 an ounce. And then once it
got, so you're talking about a very significant premium.
100%.
Right.
I call that,
that's a big premium.
That's worse than what the U.S. government was doing to you with the American Eagles. And so
right.
He, then when the price got to $6 or $7, he stopped issuing the $10 coins, and he started issuing coins with a denomination of $20. And, I never thought it was a good idea, and I told people all along, why would you buy silver for $10 when you could buy it for $5? And the really bad part about it was that the scheme took advantage of people who were, honest, sincere people who wanted to do something about the monetary system, and this was presented to them as a way to do that, and it wasn't. And Bernard von Nothaus cost problems for himself. I mean, when the government goes after a flea with an atomic bomb, you have to ask yourself, what did that person do? And he poked a sharp stick at him. He kept poking him in the eye, saying, come get me, come get me. And the big mistake he made was he put the word dollar on this coin, and they accused him basically of counterfeiting. It's not exactly counterfeiting, but that's basically what it is. And they put him in jail. And now they've gone after people on eBay who are selling these things. Why have they gone after them? They've asked eBay. They've told eBay they couldn't list them. And the problem is that it was this, the Liberty Dollar was never a solution to anything. And yet people got sucked in, and a lot of them lost a lot of money to it. And
right. He was, every once in a while, he would contact me and try and get me to promote Liberty Dollars. And I would say, no, I won't, because you're selling them at a huge premium. And this doesn't make sense. Somebody should just go off and buy 90% silver at a, if I can buy 90% silver at, 2 to 4% premium, why would I pay a 50% premium for this? And the 90% silver is legal tender. It doesn't make any sense. What you're doing doesn't make any sense. And he would get really mad at me. And, I'd get all these emails and push, and I just thought the guy was a nut. And so I did everything I could to avoid him.
Yeah. But the fact that somebody is very persuasive does not mean that their scheme is going to work at all. And in his case, that's very much the point. So it's really, you know, if you're going to set something up that you know runs contrary to the schemes of the government, then you ought to try to do it on as low scale, you know, as you need to fly under the radar if you can. I don't mean do anything illegal, but when you write the government letters and say, I dare you to indict me, they probably will. So, you know, that just, and the problem is he dragged everybody else into the problem with him, because there were other people who had, you know, there were many, many other people who had bought Liberty dollars and bought the currency, even had printed a currency, you know, and had the coins stored.
Well, on another one of my favorites that I love to pick on is Eric Sprout. When there was a real effort to push silver up in April of 2011, and of course I have very strong feelings because I think there was a lot of dirty tricks behind it, but Eric Sprout had organized a new exchange-traded fund that was at the height, I noticed, it was trading at a premium of 24% to melt value, which is nuts. In other words, you know, why would you pay 24% premium to melt value for anything? You know, I forget what silver was trading at physical, but I think it was, I don't know if you remember what the premiums were in April 2011, but
it got up to $48.50.
And so at $48, what would the premium on physical have been?
Oh, 1.5 to 4% at the most.
Right. So why would you pay a 24% premium for an ETF? So, you know, and that ETF was held out as something that would be fully collateralized and you could swap it for silver. Well, so what? You know, 24%, you'll never be able to swap for anything. So I get back to the theory that beware the alternative. And there was one other one I wanted to mention tonight, because you and I were talking about it earlier, and that's the idea of county banks. As I embroiled you in a squabble, my email squabble a couple weeks ago with a group that are promoting county banks. And essentially what they're promoting is, and I do think, you know, that state banks have been a good idea, and there's a lot, if you look at what North Dakota's done with a state bank, I think a state bank could be a really good idea. But the idea being promoted of county banks is one that literally the government starts a bank that, as far as I'm concerned, consolidates a lot of control and market share from the local community banks. It could literally put the local community banks out of business. And there's a lot about the idea to me, which is terrifying, because the last thing we need is more government intervention in the economy, in that part of the economy. So
It inevitably will politicize the distribution of credit. It's inevitably. I mean, the people who have political influence and political control are the ones who are going to be able to get credit through that bank. And that's always the reason that state banks have been founded. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the period from, say, 1820 to 1850 or so, all across the South and what was then the West, which includes what we call the Midwest today, but almost every one of those states started a state bank at some point or the other. And they all had the same purpose, and that was to issue credit. And the people creating the bank and the legislature expected to get some of the credit. So,
right.
You know, it's a scheme. I mean, it's a con game.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you look at the major credit problem right now at the local level, you have federal regulation literally forcing banks, instead of making local loans, to, you know, put the money, to not loan the money locally, but instead to buy treasury securities. So essentially, they're engineering the deposits into loans to the government instead of loans on Main Street. And that's going to be made much worse by Basel III. You know, we've gone over the Basel III regulations that have been proposed. And if you look at what Basel III would do, it would make it much worse. So you've got an entire world of community banks that are basically right now being strong-armed by the federal government to lend to the federal government and not lend locally. And if you want to loosen up credit on Main Street, that's what you do. You stop that. You don't insert another layer of banks. That's, you know, that's not going to, if anything, that's going to make the problem worse. So it's, you know, this is another example of beware the alternative, because the, you know, I keep coming back to my old mantra. Our problem is we have a group of people who are above the law and acting with impunity, and reengineering the financial system without addressing that issue is more inclined to make things worse than better. But I can't get anybody.
Well, let me drop one more thing on that. There's a new group on the scene, Gold Standard Now. They've got a lot of money, and they're making a lot of noise about reinstating a gold standard. But it's the same problem with them. You can't, if we went on a gold standard tomorrow, it would be disastrous. You have to have some kind of plan to get back onto a gold standard. But more than that, a monometallic gold standard, a, quote, gold-backed currency, is not using gold as money. It's just fiat money. The only difference is that you've got some little bit of backing by gold. That is, the banks used gold as an asset. In the period of the classical period of the gold standard in the United States, from about 25 years on either side of the Gold Standard Act of 1900, banks didn't keep 100% gold reserve. They kept a 35% reserve, and not all of that was gold. A large part of it they could satisfy by holding government bonds. So that's not a solution. That's how we got into this mess. So even though people say, well, it is.
Right. Well, that's why when you talk about financial reengineering divorced from the governance system, you know, because to me, financial systems are part of your governance system. How are you going to govern resources? How are you going to govern people? And you can't talk about it separate from that. And when you do, you get these bizarre results. So when somebody shows up, you know, deeply on a mission who's focused on one little aspect of the financial system without talking about the bigger issue of, well, who's in control and how's this going to affect that? You know, I start to get real nervous. So just what I want to remind every subscriber is beware the alternatives. You know, it's really important, whatever, especially if it's something that is involving your time and money, that you make sure that not only does it make fundamental economic sense and financial sense, but the people doing it are, you know, it's not that they're just about an alternative. It's that they're competent and they know what they're doing. And that's, sometimes it seems that that's harder than it thinks. Okay, so let me jump back to the precious metals market. We got a couple of questions, and that'll take us back into sort of what you see over the next 30 to 90 days. One question in, do you think we're going to see hyperinflation in the next couple of years? If so, what would be your exit strategy for precious metals?
If you get a hyperinflation, it's going to be very difficult to judge at the end of it whether whatever reform is put forward really will work or not. And that's the place you're going to have to make the decision. The hyperinflation, remember, can't last very long. Even in the days before any sort of electronic financial system back in Germany in 1923, the whole hyperinflation only lasted 3 years. And so, you know, they work today. If it lasted 6 months, I'd be surprised. But at the end of that, at the end of every hyperinflation, there's some kind of, quote, reform. The problem is that during the pendency of the hyperinflation, there are usually three or four other reforms. And they'll change one currency for another, and then they'll hyperinflate that. So the real problem is you're going to have judgment to know when the reform is made, which one will stick and which one will not. But I don't really, you know, here's what you've got going in your favor against hyperinflation: inertia, the inertia of the system, because nobody wants hyperinflation, least of all the Federal Reserve. So I think that inertia really works in your favor.
Okay, another one. Where do we look for gold and silver to be by June 2013, price-wise?
I'm looking for gold to be by, up to about $2,300 by, say, the 1st of June. And I'm not sure where that'll put silver, but my guess is a little bit over $50. I mean, if you go to $2,300, let's say you had a 43-to-1 ratio, that would be silver at $53.50. But if you had a 38 ratio, that would mean silver at $60.50. So I don't know. You know, silver and gold move in jumps, and they kind of leapfrog over each other. So it's harder to say about the silver than it is the gold. But I'm fairly sure gold ought to be over $2,300 by then, unless some big train wreck happens between now and then.
Well, you're much more optimistic in terms of price than I am right now. You know, what I am really looking for the primary trend to be confirmed between now and March. You know, if you go back over the last 12 years, what you'll see, Franklin, is that the gold price goes up double digit 2 years, then single digit, then double digit 2 years, then single digit. Last year was 8%. It was single digit. So I'm very curious to see where it ends the year. And just from watching the price action in the last 30 days, it looks to me like they're trying to keep it at 8 to 12% this year. You know, again, they want to rise, but a managed rise. And but I think, you know, whatever it gets held to by the end of the year, the real test then comes in March. And I don't, you know, for the wrap-up, I'm going to work on where I think it goes. You're more bullish than I am. If you're managing the rise and you want to hold it to an 8 to 12% by the end of the year, I think once that we're through that process, you know, then it's free to rise, or
Okay, let me point out something to you. I sent you a chart and you put it up. It's the gold chart that's on the blog tonight, and that shows the 150-day moving average. My 150-day moving average or running average is an average that takes the last 150 days prices and it averages them together. And then on the 151st day, you drop the oldest price and pick up the newest price. And if you look at that chart, it's that pink line is the 150-day moving average. And you can see that for most of the period since 2002, gold has ridden above that 150-day moving average. And that's normal in a bull market, that is, in a market that's in a primary uptrend, because the prices are always rising, and so the 150-day moving average ought to be rising. And whenever you get a big correction, it comes back to there. But if you'll notice where we are now, if you get over into 2011 and 2012, you see that when we got that big correction after the August high, August 2011 high, it went back under the 150-day moving average, and then it danced over it a little bit. Looks a whole lot like what happened in 2008. And when gold went under the 150-day moving average in 2008, the next thing that happened was it went up from November 2008 to August 2011, which is nearly a three-year run. So that's one of the reasons I'm optimistic about it. And if you look at where gold is in relation to that 150-day moving average, you see it looks like it's about where it was in December of 2008 in relation to that average.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons that I'm, you know, very enthusiastic about it.
I pray you're right. I pray you're right. One question. The idea that the Fed is making decisions for the best interest of the working man is nuts. And the idea that they do not know what they're doing is equally nuts. We couldn't agree more. They know exactly what they're doing. It's all about control. What better way than confiscate all fixed assets and make the population dependent? This guy's proposing digital money and verichips by 2015. I would encourage you to read my article about QE3. where I describe one of the ways you engineer the slow burn is by offsetting monetary inflation with labor devaluation. And with that, I would note that there's a story worth checking out in Michigan about the passing of the right to work laws that will allow the unions to be lose their sort of monopoly position. And if that catches on around the country, it's going to be a big, big change in how state and local government can be re-engineered. And I would just point that out. I wanted to do two things now, Franklin. One is to talk, I had not mentioned our hero of the week, and I wanted to do that. In December 10th, 2004, Gary Webb died. He was said to commit suicide. I don't believe it. Gary Webb was a Pulitzer Prize-winning American journalist who wrote the story Dark Alliance, a series of articles published in the San Jose Mercury News and then later as a book that very much nailed the story of narcotics trafficking by U.S. intelligence agencies. It's very appropriate given the HSBC story and what the U.N. advisor said that we should honor Gary Webb. We put a little thing up on the blog this week to honor him. Runner-up, I have to mention Ravi Shankar died this week. Wonderful sitar musician who brought sitar music to the West. So those are our heroes. We also have a very interesting movie, and I was so impressed because I asked Franklin to watch it, and he did. It's called Queen of Versailles. I strongly recommend it to you as a slice of insight into the housing bubble. It's the story of a couple who became literally multimillion, if not billionaires, on the timeshare part of the housing bubble, started to build a house worth $100 million, said to be the largest house in America, only to lose it in foreclosure when the bubble burst. Any comments, Franklin? You watched this documentary this week.
Well, one of the things that comes through is the way that people deceive themselves. Siegel was perfectly willing to go along with everything as long as he was making lots and lots of money, and to convince himself that it was going to go on forever. But then when the banks start closing in on him like they always do when the trouble starts, all of a sudden that's not fair. It was interesting to me. You made a point, and I'm going to just kind of take it from you, that here are these people who are worth $400 million, and they're feeding their kids food from McDonald's. I mean, it doesn't make a bit of sense at all. It's crazy. It just doesn't make any sense. But there's something about money on that scale that I'm afraid I can't. I don't understand why anybody would want that kind of money and all of the everything goes with it. It's just it was really hard to believe. I mean, that house was going to be 90,000 square feet.
Well, I've told the story on the Salir Report before. It's a reminder of how many people were swept up in it, even at the very wealthy levels, who remained remarkably clueless about what was really going on. And the proof of the pudding is they didn't protect themselves. You know, I always tell the story of the San Francisco money manager who bought $1 billion of Fannie Mae stock in the spring of 2008, only to lose the entire $1 billion position in August when Fannie Mae was nationalized. And I was kicked off of the radio show that I was doing weekly or monthly in San Francisco, out in Berkeley. You know, and the question, of course, why was, well, the San Francisco money manager put up a comment on their website saying, you know, we did very serious and careful due diligence. We had no idea there was a problem. Well, that's ridiculous. The former assistant secretary of housing was on the radio constantly for many, many years describing exactly what the problem was. So all they had to do was turn on the radio. It was common knowledge, you know, and certainly if you go talk to any trucker in America, it was common knowledge in my experience. So there's a, you know, what you see is you see this divorce between, you know, common knowledge and intelligence and the behavior of people who are swinging around hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And I think the Queen of Verse...
That was another scary thing about it. The fellow bragged that he helped put Bush in office. And he bragged that he somehow or the other precipitated the war in Iraq. Well, I don't know if he's just bragging or what. But if people like him are in charge, we're in big trouble. Because he didn't have enough judgment to see that he had ridden a credit bubble up and know it was time to get out. I mean, are they all like that?
In my experience, you have a whole layer of people who think they're insiders or not. And they may be invited to, you know, to manage large amounts of money for some period of time. But, you know, they wake up one day and discover during the contraction that they're not insiders. So it's always a shock for them. You saw that at the end of the SNL crisis. You know, it's kind of the pendulum swings, and each time the insiders get sort of wiped clean. Two more quick questions. We've gotten a fair amount of questions over the last few weeks about 401ks and 529. I've seen very little. The president, in one of his proposals, proposed sort of a plan that would encourage 401k plans by small businesses that don't have them. But that aside, and it's something that any employee can opt out of. I've seen very little discussion of IRAs and 401ks, and I think it's behind the much bigger conversation about Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. So until that sorts out, I think we won't know or see a lot about that, but it's really not on the table right now. The other question is, what would you read, share about exit strategy for precious metals? I think, you know, there are two parts of exit strategy, when you leave and where you go. And I would just note that I have, you know, in our networks, I have a lot of subscribers and clients who bought precious metals very low. And now, as a result of the success of their precious metals positions, they have what I consider to be a pretty significant concentration. And in fact, I'm looking probably in 2013 to start to move some of that out. But I continue to see precious metals as being a very, very important way to protect against inflation and against the slow burn. So even though they may start to move some out just to get the concentration down, I still see it as being a very important part of the position. And I have to say, Franklin, that once you saw what the Fed had decided to do for QE3 and now to convert Operation Twist to No Twist, Just Buy, all of that is unbelievably supportive of the precious metals price. So it makes it hard. It makes it, you know, the Fed just made it a lot more attractive to stay. At the same time, for people who have enormous gains, you know, there's a point at which I'm one of those people. I'm a bit of a squirrel. I never like to bet the ranch on anything. So
one of the things, I mean, I have hard targets for where to get out. And I have two hard targets. One is, or actually three, one is whenever the ratio of gold to silver goes down to 16 to 1, that is whenever an ounce of gold costs 16 ounces of silver or less, whenever you can buy the entire Dow for less than 2 ounces of gold or less than 32 ounces of silver, it will be time to get out. And you will not want to get, you will not want to sell. You will, every fiber of your being will say, oh no, I can't sell. I've made money with this stuff. It's been good too.
Oh no, if they're listening to me, I'll be selling before then. I don't like to be the last out. If anything, I probably go too early.
One of the problems that we have with silver is that silver becomes illiquid at the top. And so I have two plans for getting out of silver before the top, and I agree with you 100%. I don't want to wait till the end. The gold you can get out of pretty well. The silver becomes very liquid. And so for that reason, we're either going to have to be in 1,000-ounce bars stored in a COMEX warehouse, or when the ratio gets to, say, 21 or 20 to 1, we're going to swap silver for gold and ride that last little piece of the bull market up in gold rather than silver because it's so much more, it's because it's more liquid. So
yep, that is excellent advice.
Yeah.
That is excellent advice. Well, Franklin, I know one of the things I want to talk with you about is about shipping, but we're not going to talk about that tonight. We're going to save that for the first quarter of next year because, shipping gets ever more complex in this world, particularly as more and more new people come into the market. But before we end tonight, anything else you want to add? Could you just describe the debt limit chart that we put up on the blog? Because we didn't get a chance to talk about that. And that is such a thing of beauty. You sent that to me this week saying, what did you describe it as?
I got a friend who sent me this chart, and it came off of ShareLinks. And Nick Laird at ShareLinks does some great charts.
Oh, he does fabulous charts.
The debt limit rises. The gold price just rises with the debt limit, and they're almost the same line. This is a fabulous chart, and it explains exactly what's happened, but it also makes the point, which is simple, but the foundation of understanding a gold and silver bull market, they're driven by monetary demand. And when the government prints a lot of the money, then that creates monetary demand for silver and gold.
If you haven't looked at that chart, it's so, so important that you go take a look at it. It's up on the blog, both in the subscriber link area, but on the public blog as well. And one of the reasons I want to underscore this is that it is expected as part of the fiscal cliff resolution that the debt ceiling limit will be raised again. And that's if you look at the black line on that chart, what you're going to see is you're going to see at the end of this month or sometime in January, a big step up in the authorization for the ceiling. So that's going to be a very important piece of data for the precious metals market. Well, Franken, thank you so much. We are going to be back here in January for the year, the sort of first 2013 look forward and wrap up for 2012 in precious metals market report. And so we look forward to being with you then.
Well, thanks so much.
And we're not going to talk to you until January together. So I want to wish you and all the subscribers listening a very, very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Okay, so that's it for this evening. We're going to be putting up two new subscriber lunches, Portland in April and Warsaw, Poland in June. And we may do one in Memphis in January, February. We're going to see if there's enough interest. We won't have a Solari report next week because, sure enough, we're coming into Christmas. We will have John Rappaport at the last week on the 27th. The Covert Engineering of Information. I've listened to it. It's a great, wonderful piece. And then, of course, the wrap-up in the first week of January. So I won't be talking to you before for Christmas and the holidays. And so happy holidays from all of us here on behalf of the whole Solari team. I want to thank you again for a wonderful 2012. I can't tell you what it means to all of us that we have your support. You're a wonderful audience. You're a wonderful group of people. As you know, as I've described many times, I describe you as the people who hold up the world. So thank you for the extraordinary contribution you make to the world and to our lives. And if there's anything we can do to show our appreciation and do a great job for you in 2013, I hope you will continue to let us know. Well, I can't tell you how much we enjoy to hear your feedback and hear from you and how you're doing. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.